And Jennifer never mentioned the money supply or interest rates or unemployment or anything like that, and I'm not going to either. And I'm not, on the break, somebody was mentioning specialization in marriage and gains from trade and these sorts of things, sort of Gary Becker views on marriage, and I'm not even going to talk that way. I'm going to talk about marriage as an institution, as I could have said an economic institution, but for me that's redundant. So it gives you an idea that economists aren't just interested in markets and transactions and production, that we're interested in the organization of life, and marriage is a major part of life. And so we use our economic theory to understand arrangements that traditionally we don't consider economic. So I want to talk about marriage as an institution. And part of my talk is going to overlap Jennifer's quite a bit, the first part. And I had no idea what she was going to present, and her likewise. But again, it just shows you that economists can think similarly on certain topics. Like Jennifer said, marriage is something we're all familiar with. Most of us are the products of a marriage. Many of us are married. It's something we joke about. We're familiar with it in our everyday lives. And yet, we often have a hard time defining it. We often have a hard time thinking about it and trying to articulate what it is. This was never more apparent than in the same-sex marriage debate in Canada. Many academics and non-academics were caught off guard, and in trying to defend marriage, were unable to articulate why it's of value, why it's important, why we should have it. And many of the arguments just came across as against other people and why they shouldn't be involved in the franchise. And so part of what I do in my research is try to articulate a reason for why is marriage socially valuable. And what I want to do today, I'm going to talk generally about the marriage as an institution, and there's going to be a fair amount of overlap with what Jennifer said. But then in the end, I want to use a specific example of some of my latest research on what happens when we design laws ignoring the fact that marriage is a valuable institution. And that'll have to do with child support laws in Canada. Okay, well, deep down inside, so we're familiar with marriage, but deep down inside, there are things that we realize about it. One is that what Jennifer mentioned, we know that marriage is more than a contract. It has elements of contract, but there's more to it than that. That it's not just an agreement between two people. Now, this is kind of important that we realize this, because there is a strong movement in the legal profession to treat marriage just as contract, to eliminate all branches of family law and have family relations just fall under contract law. I think that would be a big mistake, but part of that comes from using contract as a metaphor for marriage, and it's not a good metaphor for marriage, just despite the fact that there are contractual elements. Again, Jennifer, you think I was copying her slides here, but we also know deep down in our guts that marriage is not a creation of the state. The state is involved in marriage, but marriage precedes the state, and marriage is independent of the state. We know deep down inside that marriage is universal. I can go to Mexico, and I will meet people that are married just like I'm married. Or if I could travel back in time or read history, I would read about marriages that are I can identify with and are similar to me. So we know that marriage is, it's universal. You go to various cultures, view things through time, and you always see marriage. Deep down inside, too, we know that societies that have traditional marriages have survived, that they've done well. When some anthropologists find some little tribe somewhere in some backwater that they don't have traditional marriage, what do we know about those places? Either they didn't survive, they were conquered by others, or their fertility rates were so slow they never grew, but they were unsuccessful in those dimensions. So deep down inside, we know that somehow marriage has this, it not only survives in itself, but it also helps the society survive as well. We know that marriage is fundamentally linked with fertility. We don't always understand how it is, but we know that when people are married, babies result and they are successful. We also realize that marriage isn't exclusively about fertility, but we know that there's something related there. We know that marriage connects children with their biological mothers and fathers, and we think that that's a good idea. We think that that marriage is both good at a gut level. We seem to know that marriage is a good idea for both the man and the woman. A lot of the arguments for bringing other people into the franchise, why we should have same-sex marriage, polygamy, all these other sorts of things, is that somehow these other groups should be allowed to benefit from these good ideas. David, I had to laugh when David said, when men get married, their testosterone levels fall. I'm married, and you can bet I didn't pick out this shirt. But beyond this, though, we kind of struggle. So we have these gut feelings about marriage. We sort of know it's right, but when it comes to articulating and defining it, we struggle. And in the policy debate, if you struggle with those kinds of things, you're going to lose the debate, and marriage is going to be worse for it. So I want to argue that marriage is an institution. And I'm going to use Doug North. Doug North is an economic historian, studies institutions. He won a Nobel Prize in 93 or 94. I'm going to use his definition of an institution. It's a humanly devised constraint that shapes human interactions. A humanly devised constraint. So it's something that it's not natural. It's not coming from nature. It's something that people think up. It's designed to constrain people. This is the counterintuitive part about an institution. Institutions are designed to tie a hand behind our back. They're designed to make us do something that we don't necessarily want to do. That's not necessarily in our own private interest, but you're for some larger purpose, for some social interest. I was interested when Jennifer was talking about that marriage often trumps biology. When you look at marriage as an institution, that's part of the objective of marriage as an institution, is that the institution is designed to trump biology. That, you know, biology is driving us to do certain things, but we want to bind our hands behind our back sometimes because what we want to do in our own private interests are not necessarily in society's interest. So I can think of this as it's a constraint that we design to affect our human interactions. I don't constrain myself just when I'm dealing with myself. I have to constrain myself when I'm dealing with others. Now, marriage is a complex institution. It's one of the most complex institutions we have in society, which is part of what makes it so fun to study, because it's not simple. But the reason why it's so complex is because there's so many different layers and individuals and organizations that are involved in designing the institution. So, just consider some of the constraints. See if you can wrap your head around this idea of as marriage as an institution that constrains. What are some of the constraints that you face? And you can probably come up with a longer list than I have. Start with the individual couple. So you have two individuals that are married. They constrain one another. They monitor each other, right? Again, Jennifer's talking about problems with what happens when you have single parents in a household and how various things can happen. Well, one of the reasons why things happen in single households that don't happen in married households is because the monitoring that takes place or that is lacking in a single-parent household. Or if the boyfriend is there, the monitoring that a girlfriend does with a boyfriend is less successful than what a spouse can do. You share benefits and costs, and shares affect the way you behave in a marriage, that where you're what economists would call you're a residual claimant, that when the marriage does well, both parties benefit. When the marriage does poorly, both parties are hurt. Well, that gives both parties an incentive to make the marriage work well and to monitor each other's performance in the marriage. They agree on things that are unobservable to others. That's very important. You cannot contract. In order to have a contract, you have to be allow a court to enforce that contract. But if the court cannot observe the performance or the lack of performance, then it's unenforceable as a contract. But in marriage, where you monitor one another on a daily basis, you can have informal contracts, if you will, that you cannot enforce at through law. So there is a contractual element of marriage, and it often happens at the individual level. And those elements constrain your behavior. Think of the wedding vows, husband and wife. So historically, to be a husband meant that you had a whole set of responsibilities and rights that constrained your behaviors. Likewise, if you were a wife, this was something that had meaning that actually constrained your behavior. You constrain yourself by promising to forsake all others, by saying, you know, I'm not going to substitute into some other person for sexual needs or whatever. for better or for worse, so it's a share contract, till death do us part, that we constrain ourselves to life in this arrangement, and no one put asunder. In other words, no one else has the right to interfere in the marriage bed. So those are things that constrain us. They're things we voluntarily agree to when we get married, but those constraints are coming from somewhere else, aren't they? Think of religious traditions. So we have this concept of marriage as being sacred. So for people that are in a religious tradition, the sacredness of marriage can act as a constraint on the way they behave inside the marriage. We have a concept of one flesh, and this idea that, you know, two people come together as one. And so in the same sense, you don't hurt yourself, you shouldn't hurt your spouse. So if you believe in these religious traditions, these traditions act as a constraint on the way you behave inside the relationship. You might belong to a faith community, and the faith community might put constraints on your marriage behavior. You might be excommunicated if you perform certain deeds, adultery, or behave inappropriately. The faith community might impose some kind of discipline on you. You're no longer allowed to be on a board of elders, or you can't teach Sunday school, or whatever. You're not allowed to vote at the general meeting. You might be socially ostracized, not invited out to the men's bowling night, or something like that. There might be peer pressure where individuals from your faith community might come over and visit you and lean on you and try to make you behave in a certain way. Think of all the constraints that family members put on a couple that are married in terms of spouse selection. So you might get a lot of advice and input from the parents on who you should be marrying. There might be wealth transfers. Jennifer was talking about that's just where, I go to my parents and ask for a mortgage. But that ability to transfer wealth across generations is one way that generations can constrain the behaviors of people that are either getting married or thinking about or are married. Advice, guidance, those can be constraining factors. Might stop you from doing something if you think, you can't face your mother at Thanksgiving. There's cultural pressures and peer pressures. And in Vancouver recently, I don't know if you've been paying attention in the news, but there have been a number of really horrific murders in the Sikh community where wives have been murdered and either the suspect or the husband has been convicted. And there was an interesting public meeting in the Sikh community in Vancouver about 2 months ago where an elderly man got up and said, back home, we would have taken care of this issue. And what he meant was there would have been a private posse that would have gone and extracted some retribution from the person involved. But, it's kind of an extreme example, but society, the culture, your local community can also be a big constraint on how you treat your spouse and how you generally behave in your marriage. The last one. So all those constraints that I put on so far, they weren't imposed by the state. We often think of marriage as only a creation of the state, when it's not. There are all those other institutional features I just talked about. But the state is involved in the marriage institution. So one way they're involved is in terms of entry conditions. Who's allowed to marry? Are there blood restrictions? Are there age restrictions? Historically, it was only one man, one woman. In Canada, we now have same-sex marriage. We don't have polygamy yet, but the state regulates who is legally allowed to marry in terms of entry conditions. That's a constraint. They regulate exit conditions. Who's allowed to divorce? Under what conditions are you allowed to divorce? Is it no fault? Is it fault? Is it irreconcilable differences? Whatever. They regulate custody laws. Is it joint? Is it shared? Is it co-parenting, etc.? They regulate property laws. You're going to divide the spoils of the marriage. Are you dividing based on title? Are you common law tradition? Is it community property, etc.? Are there fault grounds to be considered for custody, to be considered for property? There are support laws. Support laws for children, support laws for spouses. Again, that's the one I'm going to look at in a few moments. Those constrain behavior. I would even include the sex laws. So we have laws that regulate rape, sodomy, adultery, incest, prostitution, bestiality, necrophilia, voyeurism, all these sorts of things that historically what society did was it channeled and said, if you're going to have sex, the only legitimate sex to have is in marriage. Now we've been getting rid of these constraints, but historically, these were binding constraints. If you wanted to have sex, legitimately, it only could take place in one way, that society funneled our sexual behavior exclusively into marriage. And of course, we've been relaxing that over the years. So we can think of marriage like this. Think of it as a collection of constraints. And what makes it complicated is that these constraints come from so many different places, and they may not even always be consistent with one another. So you've got legal regulations, social regulations, family regulations, private orderings between the couple, etc., etc. Now, that begs the question, what is such an institution for? What's the purpose of designing an institution that constrains us like this? Why can't I just enter into any old arrangement that I want with my girlfriend? Why is that not in society's best interest? And here's where the economics of institutions starts to come in. We need institutions because they constrain us. They constrain sometimes when our private interests are not in the social interest, then we want to constrain ourselves. So Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations wrote this great book about how sometimes, often, our private vices create social benefits. So we get our dinner from the baker and the butcher, not because they're altruists, but because it's in their own interest to make a bread and to provide a meal for us. That's good for us, good for them. When that's true, we have market transactions, laissez-faire, people just make their own independent decisions. But lots of times in life, you know, our interests are incompatible. And that's when we need to bind our hands. I like that Lloyd Cohen is a law professor at George Mason, and he has the phrase unnatural marriage. That marriage is not something natural. It's not something that you know we just naturally fall into. It's unnatural. It binds us. It constrains us. Can you imagine describing marriage to a 19-year-old male who's never heard of it before? Now let me get this straight. I only get one sexual partner for life. It just doesn't make it doesn't come natural to the 19-year-old male to think about it that way. Now here, I hope this works. I've got a, you've probably seen this before. It's a little clip here, but it gets an idea on the why marriage is unnatural. What do I click here? Do I click? Technology. Yeah, it's a technology. Well, I won't have to do it. I'll have to describe this little clip. It's this clip, this guy's riding across the butte, and he hears this woman screaming. And he gets off his horse, and he looks over the cliff, and here's this gorgeous woman hanging from a branch. She smiles at him, and he tells her to hold on for a second, and he runs back to his horse, and he grabs a rope. And just before he heads back, he sees some water, this clarity water. And he takes a sip of this water, and suddenly he sees the future. And he sees this woman pregnant, baby screaming on her arm. The mother-in-law is coming out of the bathroom. You know, there's no toilet paper. And he's got another child sitting on his lap and another one beating his head. And he's all miserable. And he puts the rope back and he just rides off. And but if marriage was natural, right, we wouldn't need to have rules to constrain our behavior. If we always were going to do what was right, we wouldn't need all these rules. We need the rules because our private interests grind against the right thing to do. So, this view of institutions is what's at the core of a new body of economic theory that's often called the New Institutional Economics. It was two of the major contributors were these two guys here. There's a fellow named Ronald Coase on the left, won a Nobel Prize in, I think, 91 or 92, and that's Doug North on the right, won a Nobel Prize in 93 or 94. And they're two major founders. In a nutshell, what does this new institutional economics say? It says there's two ways to gain in life. That you can be like the person on the left here who's cooperating. So I run into somebody, I can exchange with them, I can produce things with them, we can cooperate. But unfortunately, the other way you can gain in life is you can cheat people, like the person on the right. You can pick pockets. You can be an employee who shirks, who steals, who embezzles. You can be a thief. You can be a husband that commits adultery, or a wife that commits adultery, or spends money that you know wasn't supposed to be spent, or whatever. That you can cooperate with people, or you can engage in cheating kinds of behavior. So those are the two things. When humans interact, they have that choice. The former is good and productive. The other one, of course, is dissipating and bad. So the point of the new institutional economics is we design the rules in life, we design our institutions to solve those cheating problems. We want people to come together. We want people to engage in trade and production. We want people to get married and produce children. But when they come together, they cheat with one another. So we design our institutions, whether they're firms, whether they're nonprofit organizations, whether they're families, whether they're governments, we design them in such a way to prevent what we might call opportunism. So the Coase conjecture is we're going to maximize the wealth in society net of the cost of solving these opportunistic problems. So in the context of marriage, what does that mean? We observe the institutional details of marriage because these things are designed and chosen to solve the particular problems that arise in marriage and make the institution more valuable. Okay? Marriage is designed to solve the problems of human nature, if you will, where two private, selfish individuals come together and they still remain. We might have concepts of one's flesh, but we still remain independent people. They come together and we've designed the marriage of institution to solve problems that arise when you try to procreate, when you try to raise children through the life cycle. All right, so there's things about it, yeah, so it's very complex because the problems in marriage are complex. And as a result, we end up with this very complex institution. Now, I would argue this is not the popular view of marriage. I feel like I'm preaching to a little bit to the choir here this morning. But like when Jennifer says, when you go talk on student campuses, when I teach a course on economics of marriage, the popular view of marriage is, of course, that marriage is just the formalization of a loving relationship. Two people love one another, and of course, marriage is just, as Jennifer said, it's just a piece of paper that formalizes that loving relationship. That is a totally different view of marriage than what I've been articulating. Okay? It's what I call sort of the good intentions theory of marriage. And I think much of the laws that we have that regulate marriage, especially the more recent ones, are based on a good intentions view. People come into the relationship, they have best interests in mind, you know, nobody ever changes their behavior to make themselves better off, that they, you know, they only get divorced when the marriage is dead. Nobody would ever divert resources to themselves at the expense of the marriage, etc., etc., etc. Now, here's two classic versions of these two views of marriage. So here's Christopher Marlowe's poem, The Passionate Shepherd to His Love. It's worth reading. This is almost 400 years old. Come live with me and be my love, and we will all the pleasures prove that hills and valleys, dales and fields, woods or steepy mountains yields. And we will sit upon the rocks, seeing the shepherds feed their flocks by shallow rivers to whose falls melodious birds sing madrigals. And I will make thee beds of roses, a thousand fragrant posies, a cap of flowers and a kirtle embroidered all with leaves of myrtle, a gown made of the finest wool which from our pretty lambs we pull, fair lined slippers for the cold, with buckles of the purest gold, a belt of straw and ivy buds, with coral clasps and amber studs. And if these pretty pleasures may thee move, come live with me and be thy love. The shepherd swain shall dance and sing for thy delight each May morning. If these delights thy mind may move, then live with me and be my love. This is 400 years ago when you've got somebody arguing for cohabitation, right? Here's Christopher Marlowe saying, come live with me, we'll shack up. And, you know, it'll be fantastic. You know, we'll have all these great things happen. Well, there's a response, of course, and it's Sir Walter Raleigh's response. And Sir Walter Raleigh responds, if all the world and love were young, and truth on every shepherd's tongue, these pretty pleasures might me move to live with thee and be thy love. Time drives the flocks from field to fold, when rivers rage and rocks grow cold, when Philomel becometh dumb, the rest complains of cares to come. The flowers do fade and wanton fields to wayward wintered reckoning yields. A honey tongue, a heart of gall, is fancy spring, but sorrow's fall. Thy gowns, thy shoes, thy beds of roses, thy cap, thy kirtle, and thy poses, soon break, soon wither, soon forgotten, in folly ripe, in reason rotten. Thy belt of straw and ivy buds, thy coral clasps and amber studs, all these in me no means can move to come to thee and be thy love. But could youth last and love still breed, had joys no date, nor age no need, then these delights my mind might move to live with thee and be thy love. I read that poem to my 20-year-old daughter, and she goes, let me guess which one you liked. But isn't that the truth, though, right? But could youth last and love still breathe? You know, it's like the couple, they've been married for 30 years, and they're laying in bed one night, and the wife has her back to her husband, and she suddenly feels his hand gently caress her shoulder. She's startled a little bit, and then the hand moves down her hip and down her leg, and just very gently caressing her and going all over the place, and suddenly she's starting to feel a little aroused, and so she rolls over to her husband, and as soon as she rolls over, he stops. And she says, oh, darling, what's wrong? And he goes, it's all right. I found the remote. But, see, you know what I'm talking about. But that's the truth of the matter, right? That two people come together, they can grow tired of one another, things can go wrong. They would like to maybe, in their own private interest, they'd like to leave, they'd like to part, they'd like to do various things. But there are reasons why they can't and don't, and it's the institution of marriage is what's stopping them. And I'm sure what David's going to talk about next is that, you know, when you are committed, when you do have this foundation of the institution, that actually builds love. That it's not the love that builds the institution, but it's the institution that fosters and manifests and keeps the love going in the relationship.